the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello, how are you all? Are you having a good week? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have an interview with Zuko Wilcox from Zcash, but first I have a message from my show sponsors. So you know the drill. You know I'm going to talk about. You know BlockFi, right? Have you checked them out yet? Have you signed up to their newsletter? Are you even following them on Twitter? Are you making sure that you are keeping up to date with what is happening in the world of crypto and banking? Because BlockFi are leading the way in this space. They have lots of exciting new products coming up soon, which I'm going to be telling you about. But right now, if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender. They are servicing customers all over the world, including 47 US states. And guess what? Their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin. And you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. I know, because I tried it out. I tested out the product, I had a play with it, it's so super easy to use. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000 or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. So, on to my interview with Zuko, and yes, I know not everyone is a fan of Zcash, and whilst I've been going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, I still do want to look at other projects. Sometimes this is because the people involved in the project have a history in Bitcoin, which I want to find out about. And other times it's because it's kind of like a process of elimination, perhaps understanding or finding weaknesses in projects which further strengthen the case for Bitcoin. And with Zuko, it's kind of both. I mean, firstly, he has a rich history in Bitcoin and the cypherpunk movement, and he worked with David Chaum on DigiCash, which is one of the digital currencies which predates Bitcoin. And whilst it failed, I still think it's an important part of the history of Bitcoin. Secondly, there are some interesting things about the technology behind Zcash, but there are a number of questions with Zcash too. And Peter Todd was very critical about the project and Zuko in my recent interview with him. Personally, my main issues with Zcash is that it feels like a company. And even though the company is separate to Zcash, I feel like they're intrinsically linked. And added to that, the founder's reward, which finances the project, I think further centralizes it. And centralization to cryptocurrencies always feel like a risk. I cover this with Zuko. I also question the impact of the bear market and the struggles with user adoption. And, you know, nothing came out of it which made me convinced that Zcash is something that's going to be important or be used widely in the future. You might have a different opinion, so do feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. More than happy to hear from you about this interview. And listen, if you want to support the show, then there's a whole bunch of stuff you can do. And the support I'm getting right now is absolutely insane. If you head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section, it'll explain a whole bunch of things that you can do to help with the podcast. And I do want to thank my Patreon top tier sponsors. I've got three of them. Firstly, there's Elite Crypto Consulting, your personalized trading teacher. Secondly, make sure you check out vdn.com, which is WordPress plugins for advertising and Monero mining reward sites. That is vidyen.com. And lastly, check out honeyminer.com, who make mining and earning money simple for anyone with a computer. Okay, so listen, I hope you enjoy the interview. And as I said, if you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi, Zuko. How are you?
Hi there, Peter. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you. It's nice to finally talk to you. We have been Twitter friends for a few months now, so it's nice to finally talk to you in person. Mm-hmm. So I've been going through a journey with this podcast where I'm becoming more and more of a Bitcoiner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've kind of noticed. I've listened to a couple of your podcasts.
Oh, right. Cool. Well, I'm not completely closed yet. I still own a bit of Monero, and I followed your suggestion. I added a Zcash tip jar to my website because I do want to have a play with it. I do want to see what it is about, and I am here to learn today. But I do want to go into the background a little bit because in doing my research, I've seen that you obviously have a cypherpunk background. You've been involved in this for a long time, way before Zcash. So, Zuko, can you give me your background?
Well, I'm 44 years old. I was born in 1974. And, well, I guess really the real backstory is that I was like 15 or 16 years old when the newspaper headline came out, because we didn't have the internet back then. And the newspaper headline said the Berlin Wall had suddenly been toppled and East Germans were free to travel to West Germany. And that was sort of the thing that happened at the cusp of my coming of age and having opinions about the world and theories about the future and stuff. So that seemed really momentous to me. At the time, someone named Fukuyama wrote a book that I never read, but I heard people talking about called The End of History.
Never heard of it.
Ah, well, a lot of people during that moment had a, including me, 16-year-old me, had a sort of utopian vision of major patterns of war and oppression finally being eradicated and allowing humanity to flourish as it deserves. Yeah, so that seemed like the advent of systems of oppression losing their grip and borders no longer being walls, that jail cell walls that keep people in or out. Then the next thing that happened was about, to me in my life, was about 2 years later when I discovered the internet and you could email or FTP or telnet to anywhere in the world. You couldn't World Wide Web yet. And it seemed to me to be all of the same pattern. It said to me that national borders were no longer barriers to communication. Because you're probably not old enough to remember, but back before the internet, you didn't really talk to people from other countries. And you didn't really read their newspapers or listen to their pop songs. Well, maybe pop songs on vinyl records getting smuggled in or whatever, but you didn't have friends or playmates or business partners in other countries for the most part, except for, you know, a couple of multinational corporations who had learned how to exploit that special advantage. So I thought that was really important.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I'm only 4 years younger than you. I'm 40.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you look young. Yeah, I mean, back then, you had to pay a per-minute charge to make a long-distance phone call, much less an international phone call. That would be much more. So I thought that was really important. I thought that there are billions and billions. There were only like 5 or 6 billion people on the planet back then. And I thought there are billions and billions of people, and everyone has the potential to help every other one. And that scalability, that... that super linear increase in human potential and mutual aid is the most important thing that could possibly happen at this stage of our history and our evolution. And then the next thing in my life was probably like 1 year later when I discovered some science papers about cryptocurrencies. So I fell down the rabbit hole, as we all do when we find out about cryptocurrencies. Well, I did that in about 1993, and I started skipping class and sitting out on the lawn at CU Boulder in Boulder, Colorado, reading these science papers about how to have digital money. Because it seemed obvious to me that with political freedom and with informational freedom, the next thing we needed was economic freedom in order to be able to assist each other. We can help each other a lot just with words. But we can help each other a lot more with resources and committed like engagements, like relationships, contracts, charity, etc. Okay, so that's how I got started. So I was about like 19 years old, I think, when I fell in love with what would later become Bitcoin.
So that is kind of interesting because you have lived through the pre-Bitcoin era.
Oh, yeah.
Or the original ideas, or the original cypherpunk community. Am I right in thinking you worked on DigiCash?
Yeah, I was. I was totally in love with the idea of DigiCash. That was the science papers were mostly written. Those ones that I was so enamored of were mostly written by David Chaum and co-authors, other great cryptographers of the era. And then
I met David.
You met him?
Yeah. I met him in London a few months ago. A very interesting guy. I think I got the feeling from him, almost like he is very important in the history of Bitcoin, but like the whole Bitcoin thing has kind of passed him by?
Yeah. Well, he's now joining the whole Bitcoin thing, apparently, because he has some kind of a startup. I don't know much about it. There's so much going on, I can't keep track of everything.
So, DigiCash.
So you said, did I work there? Yeah, I dropped out of school because they offered me the job of like junior coder. And I was terrible at school anyway, because I was disorganized and I procrastinated and I was depressed and had a bad diet and didn't sleep at night and played too many computer games. And I was doing a terrible job of learning anything or getting my degree. So one of the best decisions of my entire life was dropping out of school to go work for this startup chock full of some of the smartest cryptographers of the world.
So what went wrong with DigiCash? And was it kind of obvious to you that it wasn't going to succeed?
When I started, which was in early 1996, I and a lot of other people around the world thought it would succeed, because back then we thought that there was no other way to have commerce on the internet. So in 1996, we had developed the World Wide Web. And so now it was possible for people who weren't computer programmers to communicate and use the internet for the first time. And most people thought that you couldn't use normal old commerce like credit cards and your national currencies and checks. That's how we bought things back then, and paper cash. None of that was going to work on the internet. So we needed a new form of payment so that we could have the commercial version of the internet. And so a lot of people thought that DigiCash was sort of the leading technology to take that role. And now it turned out, a couple of years later, by the time I left the company, that credit cards worked just fine. Even though they were insecure, it wasn't private in a lot of important ways. It wasn't secure. It wasn't convenient. But that was good enough for internet commerce to take off during those years and leave DigiCash in the dust. And this is a lesson that I took to heart and still remember ever since. Whenever I hear people saying our thing, our technology or our social movement or our ideas or whatever it is, our thing is so good and so much better than the alternative and so important and so necessary that eventually everyone's going to see it our way. Whenever I hear that, it reminds me of what everyone said in 1996. When I joined DigiCash, that we were destined to provide this important, necessary service because it was obviously the best way to do it. And so I learned the hard way that a worse way to do it can totally be the way that everyone ends up doing it. And so if you're saying to yourself, or if you're saying to each other, we're going to win because our way, our thing is obviously better, that's a warning sign. You should raise a little red flag in your mind and say, wait, what did I just say? Where is this going to lead us if we believe that? I think it'll lead you to failure.
Okay, so DigiCash ends, and there is a gap between that and the arrival of Bitcoin. So what were you doing in between, and were you aware of Bitcoin from the point it was announced?
I think I heard about it on the cryptography mailing list where Satoshi posted it. Like a lot of the people on that list, I kind of gave a quick read through of the white paper and said, yeah, it's really cool, but this will never actually work in practice. You know, it's fundamentally not going to work. I then wrote the first blog post about Bitcoin on the internet like a month later or so. And Satoshi thanked me and, linked to my website from the original bitcoin.org website. In the interim, I worked on some other privacy enhancing decentralization technologies. I went through the .com bust in 1999-2000, which was a great practice run for the crypto bust that we're going through right now. So I learned some more lessons the hard way, which I've taken to heart and continue to benefit from. Then there was the long, like what was effectively the dot-com winter, right? Like a multiple year stint during which it was hard for me and anyone to get work at all, to take care of our families. And there was a lot of sort of disillusionment with the promise of the internet and the promise of these new technologies. There was a lot of like sort of mockery, like that whole thing, that whole internet business idea. Especially some of the things that were dearest to my heart the whole time, which was freedom of speech, privacy, decentralization, decentralization of power, I mean, decentralization of political power, consent, security, all of these things were really important to my heart. And during those years, I kind of felt like everyone else either, you know, pivoted away or lost interest or changed their minds or whatever. And this guy, Scott McNeely, who was a big deal in Silicon Valley for a couple of years, said, privacy is dead, get over it. And I felt like basically I couldn't find anyone else who disagreed with him besides myself. So I felt pretty lonely. And then it was more or less just Bitcoin that Satoshi single-handedly turned that around. Because the fact that Bitcoin did work in practice, despite all the experts like me saying that it couldn't, that's what caused people to care about privacy again. And I think that's really interesting. I'm not sure what happened there, that sort of a demonstration of feasibility is what got people excited and got like a whole bunch of different people who all cared about the same stuff to come out of the woodwork and meet each other and realize they had this in common and turn into a movement. It wasn't in the other order. It wasn't like a whole bunch of people who cared about this stuff got together and said, we all are going to cooperate. We care about this stuff. Let's find some way to make it happen. Instead, Satoshi gave us the way in the first place. And that's how everybody met each other.
So why did Bitcoin work then?
Why did it work? I'm still not convinced it works. It's only worked for like 10 years. Come on. It's a blip. It's a fluke.
So why has it worked so far then?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, the specific things that I thought wouldn't work about it were technical details about the consensus algorithm, clock synchronization, you know, the game theoretic reasons why different participants like miners and full nodes would or wouldn't cooperate with each other. And that's what I'm still not sure actually is going to continue to work. A lot of other people had different reasons, not cypherpunk so much, but more like economists and other thinkers. Once they found out about it a few years later, after it had been working for a few years in practice, then they said this can never work for their economic reasons, like because we need some wise woman, I guess, to steer the economy or press the accelerator and the brake on the economy, which I think is a stupid analogy that has nothing to do with the real economy. I remember there's this hilarious to me quote from Nick Szabo. He said something like, I was told frequently and with, I forget, this is not a quote, this is a paraphrase. I was told frequently and with great confidence that money could not possibly work like that. I love that part because both the network security game theory consensus algorithm part and the money part could still fail, but having worked for 10 years is a great data point.
And how involved were you? Did you contribute to the code and the community? How involved were you with early Bitcoin?
I contributed to security. I read some of the source code looking for security problems, found one, reported it to the then maintainer, Gavin Andreessen. I wrote quite a few blog posts. I think they're maybe dead now because they were on Google Plus and I haven't gotten around to backing up my Google Plus, and apparently they're taking down Google Plus. Anyway. But I wrote, you know, I was somewhat active on blogs, mailing lists, Bitcoin Talk, contributed to the original Bitcoin Foundation, which was some of the worst money I ever spent. hopefully no Bitcoin Foundation people hear me say that. Listen to your podcast. I went to conferences and I hung out on IRC a lot on, like, I guess Bitcoin-dev IRC, and expressed my opinions about technical stuff with the other hackers who hung out there. Stuff like that. I never contributed any patches that got accepted into Bitcoin Core yet.
Okay, but you were there and you're part of it. But before we start talking about Zcash, like, what is your view on Bitcoin now? Can you kind of summarize for me your main kind of thinking that you have with Bitcoin right now, your interest or your disinterest?
My overall thinking is that Bitcoin itself was unique, right? You know the word sui generis? I love this Latin word. A sui generis is an animal which isn't one member of a species. It's the only member of its species, like a mythological beast, like the Hydra or something. So Bitcoin was unique when it was born. And like I say, I think it's a miracle and amazing that it worked, because something so creative and out there is almost guaranteed to fail the first few times. And it's like you gotta take many shots at it before you get lucky and hit the target. And what I think about it now, after 10 years and the evolution, or, you know, sort of hardening that it's undergone, is that it's pioneering a really important part of the design space, which is the maximally predictable part of the design space. There's a huge amount of value in that. I appreciate that Bitcoin does that so that Zcash doesn't have to as much. Like, people who want maximal predictability can rely on Bitcoin for that, in terms of the blockchain, owning the tokens, the coins themselves, making their plans around the, like, what's Bitcoin going to be like in 4 years. Of course, we might be really badly surprised by Bitcoin doesn't change, but the world around it changes, and then turns out it's not going to operate the way we thought it would operate. But at least you can factor out the question about how the core protocol is going to change, and maybe to some degree the culture, because it's such a large culture now, and larger cultures, I think, can change more slowly, or more diverse cultures. Anyway, I really appreciate that, so that Zcash can explore a more dynamic spot in the design space.
And so why Zcash then? Why did you not just dedicate yourself to Bitcoin? Why did you decide, actually, you wanted to do something else? You wanted to do Zcash?
What came out of the science and the technology, you know, I've been a technologist and scientist all along. And I and a lot of Bitcoiners thought from the beginning that privacy was really essential, and that the sort of first version of Bitcoin wouldn't measure up to that need. Like Hal Finney, who was a friend of mine, and I miss him, and Satoshi, and a lot of others, talked at some length about the privacy problems in the Bitcoin design and how to mitigate them. But there was, in my opinion, at that time, like nine years ago now, my opinion at that time was that there's basically, and it's still true today, but let's, like, rewind in history. So, because you're asking me what was my motivation, how did I start working on Zcash? So the answer is, privacy and decentralization were basically the two features of Bitcoin at the beginning. That's why pretty much 100% of all the people who cared about Bitcoin and even knew what it was, why they cared about it. And in fact, nowadays, my perspective is, or maybe this was true at the time, I don't remember, but my perspective is that privacy and decentralization are basically the same thing as each other. Like, if you have sufficiently strong privacy, that causes decentralization. And if you have sufficiently weak privacy, then that causes centralization, because whoever is the most powerful organization in your area can just say, hey, we're watching, and you don't want to do stuff that we don't like. And that means they're the central controller of what everyone does. So I think privacy and decentralization are pretty much inseparable. One of the reasons why Bitcoin might fail in some ways.
Because, sorry, I don't understand. It might fail because of what?
Because it has such bad privacy properties that it's going to be increasingly possible for power mongers to control what everyone's allowed to do with it.
How?
Well, if you want to ban books, you don't do it by like intercepting shipments of books and grabbing them before they reach like your border or whatever. What you do is you just let everyone know certain books, if you're like found with them, or if people hear or see that you've been reading those books, we're going to know about it. And you don't want us to think that of you, or you might suffer consequences. That's how you ban books in practice. So privacy of who finds out what you do, and really importantly, whether you get to choose who finds out or whether you don't, that's just necessary for decentralization of power. Does that make sense? That's my opinion.
Yeah, kind of. It depends what you say failure is or what fail is.
Yeah. Yeah, so I used like a trigger word. That was a loaded word, right?
Yeah, it kind of is, because like, what does fail mean? Does it die and miners give up and blocks don't get created? I don't really know what fail is, but I kind of understand your point. Okay, so...
Well, let's rewind, because I was saying that in 2009, Satoshi and Hal, and I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I was pals with a lot of the Bitcoin core devs on IRC even before they and I got into Bitcoin. And because, we worked on other open source hackery together, and I'm basically going to say that until many years after Bitcoin launched, privacy was universally understood to be one of the essential purposes and features of the whole thing by everyone involved. And so, like, Satoshi and Hal talked about whether it would be possible to use some form of encryption to protect people's information when they were using Bitcoin. And at that time, in 2009, when they were having this conversation, it wasn't, because the sufficiently advanced cryptography had not yet been discovered. I'm trying to answer, this is a very, very long-winded answer to your question of how did I get started on Zcash? And the answer is, some scientists discovered a way to add privacy into an open public ledger. And then they asked me to productize it and make it full scale and reliable for the whole world. That's how I got started. Oh, and one more detail. They gave a talk about this innovation, which at that time was called Zero Coin. It was a science paper. And they gave that at the 2013 San Jose Bitcoin Conference. Which is basically like the first, it wasn't the first conference, but it was kind of the first big conference with a whole bunch of sort of outsiders, venture capitalists, and it was the first one I attended. And so the scientists who come up with Zero Coin gave a talk about their idea, and it was presented as an extension to Bitcoin. It was, the whole science paper is written like, take Bitcoin, make these changes to it, and then you can have privacy integrated into your Bitcoin. And the some of the Bitcoin core devs who were also presenting on other topics at the same conference, and I forget who it was. I know Greg and Luke Jr. were there, I think, and I know Peter was there. It's when I met at least two out of three of them for the first time in real life. But someone from the Bitcoin core dev team made a statement during, like, at the end of their presentation. They said, oh, by the way, we've been hearing a lot of buzz about this Zero Coin proposal. And it was true, because, like I say, like, literally everyone, maybe by now it's not everyone, this is 2013, maybe there's like 5% of the people at the conference who don't care about privacy, but a lot of people basically cared a lot about privacy, and there's a lot of buzz about the Zero Coin proposal. And so the Bitcoin core dev, whoever it was, said, by the way, we're hearing a lot of buzz about this proposal to add this new feature into Bitcoin. And we just want to be absolutely clear, that's not going to happen anytime soon. We're not going to support putting this radical, experimental new thing right into the core protocol. The message size is like 40 kilobytes for every transaction. We don't know if that would work. And Bitcoin is too important to be experimenting on like that. So instead, they should take this idea and deploy it in some kind of altcoin like Litecoin. And then if it works there, then we could consider upgrading Bitcoin after we've learned from that. Which is one of the first good signals of this thing that we talked about earlier, about how Bitcoin has gotten very, very stable and like conservative and reliable, or like predictable. So anyway, that's how I got started, is that the Bitcoin core devs said they weren't going to support modifying Bitcoin anytime soon. And then the scientists, after a couple of more science innovations they had to come up with, asked me to productize it. That's how we got started.
So would you say that Zcash is superior to Bitcoin? And that is obviously a loaded question.
Yeah, it's another like trigger word loaded question. It's at a technology level, it's kind of like got one more feature, and most of all the features that it cloned off of Bitcoin in the first place. But more importantly, at a like culture and network level, they're different. They're exploring different parts of the design space, right? Because Zcash has regular network upgrades in which everyone has to upgrade if they want to use the new rules. And Bitcoin explicitly doesn't do that. So it's a lot more long-term predictable and changes a lot more slowly at that layer, like layer one. And Zcash changes faster at layer one than Bitcoin does, but probably slower than Ethereum does.
Next up, I talked to Zuko more about Zcash, but before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So, BlockFi, one of a handful of companies that I'm excited about. This bear market, you know, it's been pretty grim on a lot of us. I think it's been good at highlighting some of the great companies out there, ones that are building companies that create value, that are going to be here for years to come, that are going to support the crypto and Bitcoin ecosystem. BlockFi are definitely one of those. They've been creating value from the start. They've built an excellent company. They've got a great website. It's easy to use. They're creating value now. They're moving the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency ecosystem forward. They are doing this by bridging the gap between cryptocurrencies and the real world, something which is desperately needed. I mentioned this before. I had a real difficulty getting a bank account for my business just because I've touched crypto. I was rejected by 6 banks, but now I've got a bank account, and it was hard work. I actually got it through a company called Tide. Hopefully it's going to be companies like BlockFi are going to make this easier in the future. It's going to make it easier for people who are working with crypto and Bitcoin to get bank accounts. Now, they aren't just a loans business. Whilst we talk about the loans product a lot, with the additional $4 million in finance that they raised last year, they're looking to create a suite of new products. They're going to have crypto credit cards, and they're also going to have a crypto savings account that earns interest. So that's pretty cool. We'll likely be talking about that on the podcast in the future. So make sure you keep an eye on BlockFi, because they are one of the most important companies in the space. And listen, if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US. They service customers worldwide, including 47 US states. They accept Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at BlockFi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. So you know the drill. Check out blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. Again, that is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. Okay, let's talk about one of my other sponsors, BitRefill. Talked about these a few times. Another proper crypto business, another business which is creating value, another which is allowing people to use their crypto and Bitcoin. BitRefill is helping people live on crypto, allowing you to buy gift cards, top up your phone, and pay for bills with Bitcoin, Dash, Dogecoin, Litecoin, and Ether. With over 130,000 people in over 170 countries having used them, you know BitRefill has got game. I've been on the website, I played with it, I bought my son a PlayStation gift card with Bitcoin, and honestly, it was so easy. 4 steps. I selected the PlayStation Network, I selected the amount, which was £20, I sent my Bitcoin over and the payment was detected immediately, and it only required one confirmation and I received my code and instructions in less than 30 seconds. Honestly, it was insanely quick, it's insanely slick, definitely go and check them out. BitRefill has so many other vouchers. They've got Spotify, PlayStation Network, Steam, Hotels.com, ASOS, and Virgin, just to name a few. If you head over to their website at bitrefill.com, which is bitrefill.com, and you can check it out. They are the easiest way to use your Bitcoin and altcoin to buy gift cards and top up your phone. That is bitrefill.com, again, bitrefill.com. Right, so is Zcash a company then?
That's a good question. You're asking really good questions. I really appreciate having this opportunity. There's a company that we've been calling the Zcash company, but that's confusing, and we're going to rename it. Its legal name, if you want to look it up at like the Secretary of State or whatever, is the Zero Coin Electric Coin Company. And that's not Zcash, right? It's like asking, it's like somebody coming along from outside and they sort of mistake Blockstream for Bitcoin. You know, they're like, I want to talk to the CEO of Bitcoin, right? That's kind of a similar mistake. The Zero Coin Electric Coin Company, of which I am the CEO, is far from all of Zcash. For one thing, there's a whole bunch of open source hackers and other companies around the world that support Zcash in various ways. For another thing, there's a nonprofit foundation, which is separate from the company, that's called the Zcash Foundation, that supports Zcash in different ways. So no, it's not a company.
It is not a company. But from an outsider, you know, someone like me, there appears to be an intrinsic link between the protocol and the company.
Yeah, there's two intrinsic links. One is the founder's reward, where the consensus rules send money directly to several different parties, including the company and the foundation and a bunch of early founders. So that's like a financial funding link, which is super important because your funding, I think, strongly influences your course over the long haul, over multiple years. And the other link is just that the company is the most organized and vigorous writer of software. So the company is authored almost all of the patches that have gone into the mainline like reference client, you know, Zcash D, the primary client that everyone runs. Now, there's recently been a project launched by the foundation and Parity, you know, that Ethereum company, Parity. They have agreed to make a separate independent client. So they succeeded that. And I know that their GitHub has been active, so they're actually doing something, but I haven't tried it yet or anything. So if they actually succeeded that will really change this. But currently the Zcash company is super important because we're the only ones that implement and maintain and upgrade the core implementation.
Right. So if something was to happen to the company, then the protocol would, likely die?
Oh, I totally disagree.
Oh, okay. Well, what would happen? Would it just open source into the community?
Well, there's already a community. They wouldn't stop, I don't think, if the company like imploded. It might actually stimulate more energy because it could be... There's sort of a crowding out concept, which is if everybody thinks you're going to do a thing, then nobody else is going to start doing it. You know? But even, we don't even have to speculate about what would happen if the company were to turn evil or get bought by Microsoft or whatever. Because we can already see that there are a bunch of other things outside the company. Like there's a wallet called Zec-QT-Wallet, which they have a new release with new user visible features like Tor integration and other kinds of like cool sounding features like every month, I think, pretty frequently. I mean, it's you might be right. Like Zcash might die, Bitcoin might die. Might not. Hard to tell about the future.
So if the founder's reward is used to support the company, does that put an additional downward pressure on the price? Because I'm guessing that the founder's reward is kind of cashed in monthly. And when Zcash is at $50 as opposed to $800, then there is an additional pressure to sell it. Then if more is being sold by the company than is being bought to be used, then this puts additional pressure on the price. I mean, I don't trade anymore, so it doesn't really affect me, but it will affect others.
I read your story about trading and mining. That was amazing, man.
Oh, God, yeah.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated you being able, being like willing to be transparent about your own experience. Like, you're exposing yourself financially and emotionally to the public. And I really appreciate that, because that kind of like, so many things like that have happened to so many people, but almost nobody wants to talk about it. And that means everyone else doesn't get to learn and understand and sympathize with people.
But, you know, people are talking about it now.
Maybe partially you've inspired them.
Yeah, but maybe. But you know what it was? I said about this before and people were like, oh, you're so brave. But I never felt like that. I just felt a responsibility because I have a podcast and I've talked about trading before. Yeah, you know, back to my original point.
Yeah. Yeah, so your question was, does the founder's reward put downward pressure on the price? That's great. I love these questions. This is exactly the kind of stuff I was hoping for, because these are questions that a lot of people seem to have based on like Twitter, based on, you know, me reading Twitter. And so I'm glad you bring it up. And I totally disagree. I think it doesn't make any sense at all to think that, because the founder's reward. So what we did is we cloned Bitcoin, right? And we said, so in Bitcoin, there's 100% of the coins. It's like 50 coins every block. And there's a block every 10 minutes for the first 4 years. And we cloned that. And then we said, but instead of 50 coins every 10 minutes, it's going to be 40 coins every 10 minutes to the miners and 10 coins every 10 minutes to the founders. Now, why would you think there would be a higher sell pressure from founders than from miners?
It's a fair point. I hadn't really thought about it like that.
I think it's the opposite. I think mostly the founders are not me. Like, probably 90% of the founder's reward, I don't even know what happens to it, because it goes to other parties that I have no insight or control over them. But I'm guessing, based on who they are and what they say, that they've probably sold very little of it ever, is my guess. So I think it's quite the opposite. I think miners have to sell because they have expenses, as you well know. Founders maybe don't. So I think it's the opposite. But also, I think the question itself, the fact that so many people on Twitter have this question, I think it shows a real misunderstanding about the founder's reward. I think they basically are thinking, because there's this founder's reward, there's more issuance. Whereas if you think about it as there's the same issuance, but part of it goes to founders instead of going to miners, then that totally changes your thoughts about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it hadn't really crossed my mind like that. The other thing I'm considering, that this bear market has been rough, right? We have seen it with Gigawatt going bust.
Oh, hell yeah.
Bitmain aren't looking great. Shapeshift has had to lay off a bunch of people. I mean, ultimately, I think it is healthy, but I guess there must have been some impact on the company as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because if Zcash is your funding, a bit like, sorry to compare you to Ripple Coin, but, you know, they are funded by selling XRP, right?
Oh, yeah.
Their major source of funding. So I guess if your company's funding is from the founder's reward and the reward is getting lower, it must put additional pressure on the company, has it?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. The company is funded entirely. I mean, we originally raised $3 million way back in the day from these private investors to get started and hire engineers and build it in the first place. But, you know, that's long since run out. We had spent most of the $3 million before it even launched. So we've been depending on the part of the founder's reward. I call that part the dev fund, because, like I say, 80% goes to the miners. Like, about 15% goes to reward early founders, like scientists, employees, advisors, early employees, stuff like that. I'm one of those, but I get like 1%. So 14%, I get less than 1%. So like 14% for all the other early founders, 1%, less than 1% for me, 2 or 3% for the company. And that's what I call the dev fund, and 2 or 3% for the foundation. Which actually is a pledge from me and my a few other people, but I had the most. So when I pledged to send half of mine to the foundation, that was the most. So my point is, yeah, the company is totally depending on this 2 or 3% that it gets every month or every block from the Founders Award. Now, we've basically lucked out, or maybe I should say, we were very prudent because, like I said, I went through the dot-com boom and bust, and there's a lot of experienced people involved in the Zcash company who either were there or have learned carefully, or both. So we didn't ramp up as hot. We didn't increase our spend nearly as much as most other projects did. I remember I went to some conference 2 years ago, maybe, where Ripple was there, and their whole pitch, their whole speech, I forget who the guy was, but his whole speech was like, we have this giant office in San Francisco, and we have like 135 engineers who were improving it every day. And I was really intimidated. I was like, oh, fuck, they have so much money. They have like as much money. They can do whatever they want. And I've just got like these 15 coders and me and, you know, a couple of marketing and admins. And so I was kind of intimidated. But anyway, the bottom line is we operate pretty efficiently, so we can endure crypto winter as is with our 32 employees and keep doing what we've been doing, which I'm really proud of, both parts. Like, we don't have to do layoffs, which is really great for the people who would otherwise have to be laid off. And the rest of the community can depend on the company to keep doing the kind of innovation that it has done all along until the Founders Award runs out. That's a different question.
All right. Well, listen, look, I'm not going to go into the tech. I think this has been covered well, and you did a great show with Laura Shin, and I'll share that on the show notes if people want to find out more about the tech.
Okay. Well, allow me to just say the tech is awesome. We have done such a fantastic job. It's absolutely the best. It's the only time that that level of sophisticated new science has been productized and deployed to this large number of people so reliably in so few years, basically, ever.
Yeah, but the most important thing now is to explore adoption, because look, you can have the best tech in the world. If there's no adoption, this is kind of meaningless. And like, I did an Ethereum show, I did an Ethereum interview recently, and I read a whole bunch of stuff about Ethereum 2, and if they can achieve their technical goals, if they can solve these technical problems, then the level of computer engineering required is insane. But it means nothing if all it can do is issue a stablecoin. But who is the target user for Zcash? Because I'm looking at adoption. Right, so we have MakerDAO, right, and DAI appears to be in use. Okay, so we have that. There's Augur with a small amount of use, and there's some random stuff on EOS, but I don't really care about that.
What was the other thing before EOS and after DAI?
Augur.
I don't know what that is.
You don't know Augur, the betting
app? Yeah, the betting thing, yeah. But it has very low usage, right?
Yeah, very low usage, and they apparently have fudged some of the figures. Have they, or somebody else has? I don't know, I read about that.
Yep.
Bitcoin is being used to a certain extent, probably the most of anything. I mean, I used it yesterday on BitRefill to buy my son a PlayStation voucher.
Nice.
And I guess Monero is being used to like a limited amount on some dark markets. So there are some use cases, but I haven't seen it with Zcash, probably because I'm not close to it. But who is the target user of Zcash, and what would they use it for?
You're asking currently who currently uses it, or who are we designing it for the future adoption?
I think both questions are valid.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that question. Once again, good job on the questions. You know, dark markets are a lot more Bitcoin-centric than Monero, right?
Oh, of course, yeah, but that is the only use of Monero that I am aware of. I've also read about these drop gangs.
Oh, that was baloney. That was like speculative fiction or design work. That thing doesn't actually exist. It was presented as though it actually exists, but it was like hypothetical, in my opinion. I don't think that really happens yet. So I'm looking at my dashboard on Messari.io, which shows a whole bunch of blockchain statistics. I'm looking at what they call NUM payments, which is Messari.io's measure of financial transactions on a blockchain. And they say 4,660 per day for Monero right now, 340,000 per day for Bitcoin right now, and 210,000 per day for Ethereum right now. All right, so on there, there's a thing called NUM payments. And this is Messari.io's attempt to count the number of financial transactions, not like computer transactions on a blockchain. So that's why Ethereum, they figure there were 210,000 Ethereum payments just in the last 24 hours. But there were a lot more Ethereum transactions, which were just like whatever, smart contract API calls or something that weren't payments.
So you are number 10 in terms of payments. So I'm looking at this for Zcash. It says 33,205. But what makes up those?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a really good question. I think a lot of it must be mining, because there are a lot of Zcash miners. There were a lot more. There were probably 10 times as many Zcash miners before the ASICs kicked in last summer. But this number didn't fall by 10 times when the number of miners fell by, I estimate, 10 times. I don't know how far this number fell last summer.
But it feels a little bit like when I had my web agency and we used to look at page views. It feels a bit like a vanity metric. I wanted to know where people are actually using this and who should and who could, as adoption is a problem across the space.
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of like shops who care about privacy and decentralization, who accept Zcash in return for their goods and services. There's this community thing called Pay with Zcash. I don't know who it is, but there's somebody out there called whose name is Pay with Zcash that monitors all the shops around the world that accept Zcash payments. You can check them out. But I don't imagine there's that many. I don't think there's 33,000 payments a day to those shops. I know that Zcash is one of the most heavily traded coins in OTC markets, like the, you know, these big private traders like Cumberland and Circle and Galaxy and whoever else. Because we talk to them and they say that Zcash is like, I think what they say is it's one of the top five most frequently traded or most heavily traded coins in their books. But I don't know. I maybe most of it's mining. There's still a lot of Zcash miners because it's still one of the most profitable coins to mine overall worldwide. Like on this list, if you still have that Messari thing open, there's a really important number, which is new issuance, 24-hour USD. I basically think that's the number one most important number because it's the hardest to fake. It's the hardest for it to be off for some bizarre reason, like somebody's left a bot running that generates 10,000 transactions a day or whatever, right? It's the hardest for anyone to fake, misreport, game, fake, whatever. And so it says that Zcash is worth, it says that every day there's $400,000 worth of Zcash that's either mined and sold or mined and held. Which basically makes it, it's been basically tied for third is for the years that I've been watching after Ethereum and Bitcoin. And it's tied with either Bitcoin Cash or Litecoin, although recently Bitcoin Cash dropped by half on this metric. So now it's just tied with Litecoin. Zcash is tied with Litecoin on this metric. So I don't know. There's a lot of nonprofits that accept Zcash donations. There are people who have used Zcash in Venezuela, but none of this can add up to 33,000 payments a day. So I don't know. It must be miners or traders.
And it feels a little bit like these are just kind of like small examples. It doesn't feel like there is mass usage there or mass adoption. And for something like Zcash and Monero, and to some extent Bitcoin, it needs to be used because, you know, look, Zcash is not a store of value, right? It's a method of transfer. But it's going to be an issue for everyone. If there is no adoption, then the miners will keep selling every day. And while there will always be someone willing to buy at a certain price on exchange, right? If the price keeps going down, it will come to a point where it's not profitable to mine. And then there will be less miners. And then it will be less secure. So it's almost like a death spiral without adoption. So is adoption something that you, the company, is focusing on?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of our three core pillars of our company strategy. Our company strategy is A, adoption without sacrificing security. and B, investing in our own team, which, as I said, is small and efficient enough that we can keep doing it. And C, openness and transparency, like facilitating these third parties like Parity and those hackers that I mentioned, to be rewarded and effective at contributing to the whole ecosystem. So adoption is absolutely one of our primary focuses. And there are two parts to that, distribution and user experience. So distribution is things like, what does it take to get a hold of a Zcash? And this is where I'm really sad about the mining dropping from like literally hundreds of thousands of miners to tens of thousands of miners is my estimate. Because that's a way for people to get a hold of Zcash, even if they mostly have to sell it. Hopefully they don't sell all of it right away or whatever. And another form of distribution is being able to buy on exchanges, right? Or being able to sell your goods and services in return for accepting Zcash payments. And that's where we've done a fantastic job of getting Zcash listed on almost all the major exchanges, including Gemini and most recently Coinbase, which are the most important ones in the United States. And I'm really proud of that because for a long time, people very confidently said, just like people used to tell Nick Szabo money can never work like that, people used to always go around saying privacy can never be on a mainstream exchange. And I was like, I don't think you're going to be proven right. And so far, I've been proven right.
I thought those mainstream exchange listings don't allow you to use the privacy option.
That is another common sort of misunderstanding of the way it works. Like, but it's true that Gemini and Kraken and Coinbase and the other large exchanges that support Zcash don't use shielded addresses. They only use transparent addresses, right? But they can't stop you from using the privacy features if you withdraw to your own wallet, right? Like, are we talking about using an exchange as a way to acquire Zcash, which is what I think it's for? It's like a distribution method, because if someone is interested and they want to try it, they have to have a way to get some. Or are we talking about using the exchanges as your hot wallet, which nobody thinks is a good idea?
No. It's more like, look, I understand there is a difference between shielded and unshielded transactions. I guess it is good for onboarding because people can buy now.
Yeah.
But how does it work for offboarding if I can't send shielded transactions to Coinbase to sell?
All right. So let's not talk about transactions as being shielded or unshielded. Let's talk about addresses as being shielded or unshielded. And that shows you, and that's the fact at the technical level. You can have any combination of shielded inputs or unshielded inputs and shielded outputs or unshielded outputs, okay, at the like protocol level. And then at the like business and user experience level, the way it works in practice today is that each user gets to choose, like when you create a new address, do you create a shielded one or do you create an unshielded one? Okay. Now, Coinbase, when it creates new addresses for its users to deposit into, it only creates transparent ones. Although they have said that they intend to upgrade to creating shielded ones for themselves in the future, as has Gemini. But like if you have a Zcash wallet on your laptop and you create an address, you're the one who gets to choose whether to create a shielded or unshielded address on your laptop. Then if you send from your wallet on your laptop to Coinbase, you can send from a shielded address on your laptop to Coinbase.
Is there any history to that coin which exposes it?
It's like this. Have you seen a blockchain? You've looked at Bitcoin block explorers, right? Did they show you inputs, outputs, change, like probable change or whatever? You can't tell exactly what's the change, but there's a few inputs, there's a few outputs. They each have an address, there's amounts, et cetera. There's transaction fees, you see all that, right? If you look at the Zcash block explorer, any one of the Zcash block explorers, what you'll see is whenever the input was a transparent address, which I call a tatter for short, because I say it too many times a day. Whenever the input was a tatter, then it looks just like a Bitcoin block explorer. You see the address on the block explorer, on the publicly visible web. If the input was a zatter, then what you see is like just a question mark or a blank space, depending on how the block explorer shows it. Because the block explorer doesn't know which Zadar is the origin of this outgoing payment. And then similarly with the outputs, if the recipient of the transaction is a tatter, then you just see the tatter, which looks exactly like a Bitcoin address, except it starts with a T. If the recipient was a Zadar, then you just see a blank space that says like 10 Zcash went to ? Okay, so if you have some Zcash, if somebody tips you Zcash, which they totally should, all Zcash users should tip you right now in order to motivate you to play around with it and learn how it works.
You should be the first one.
Okay, but you won't know if I am because I'll do it from a Zadar. So all you'll see is like a ? Saying, like when you look at the Block Explorer or your wallet, it'll say somebody, but we don't know who, sent you 1 Zcash to your tatter. I'll have to be fast to be the first one.
Well, the show won't come out until next week and nobody has done one yet, so you can do the first one. But I would have broken your privacy there, right? I'll know it is you.
That's a really good lesson about the fragility of privacy due to metadata. Absolutely correct. Really important. But yeah, so if you got a Zcash in your wallet, in your local wallet, what wallet are you using? You
know? I did it on Ledger.
Okay. So it's Ledger's great because it's a hardware wallet and it's much safer against being hacked over the internet. Downside is Ledger does not yet support shielded addresses. So what you would see on the blockchain is ? Sent 1 Zcash to your tatter, which is in your ledger. And then if you deposit it to Coinbase, what you'll see is your tatter sent 1 Zcash to Coinbase's tatter.
It sounds so complicated. And this is one of the things with adoption. My fave book when I had my agency was Don't Make Me Think by Steve Crook, which is just a brilliant design book.
Uh-huh.
And I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, whew, this sounds complicated. Like Bitcoin is already complicated. And Then this is like another layer. Is this another thing you're coming up against for adoption?
Absolutely. I told you that distribution and UX are the two ingredients for adoption, right? And like product market fit, a use case where people need it. And it's better, substantially better than anything else they could use to satisfy their need. Well, distribution we're doing great at because of Coinbase and Gemini and many, many others all around the world. UX, Zcash and Bitcoin and Ethereum suck at UX, right? The user experience is baffling, scary. People accidentally delete their money all the time. People get robbed all the time. Even if they don't get robbed, even if they don't manage to delete their money, they still can't figure out how to buy a thing, how much the thing will cost, how to get paid. It's so bad in all possible ways. Worst UX that has ever been this successful as it is today. And that's one of the things we do at the Zcash company is out of those 32 employees that I mentioned, several of them are full-time user experience experts that have been working for months now since like mid last year on designing a better experience that makes sense to people and testing it on live users, like asking a whole bunch of users, hey, try this out. Tell us what you think while you're trying it so we can learn. Anyway, so one point about UX I totally take to heart is I'm sitting here trying to explain to you there's two different things, they interact in this way, you get better privacy in some cases than others, and I think you're very correctly saying that is way too much for normal users to even listen to, much less just make decisions about how they're going to handle it. And so in the long run, for better improved user experience, what we have to do is make Zadars the ubiquitous default, right? So the right way for UX to work is you bought a ledger, it arrived in the mail, you told it, please give me a Zcash address so I can receive tips. It gave you a Zadar and it didn't ask you about, would you like the old bad kind or the new good kind? No, it doesn't ask you that. It just gives you the new good kind. And then you put it on your website and then people tip you and nothing about your finances or what addresses you're using is revealed to hackers throughout that process. That's good UX. We're aiming in that direction. It's a lot of work.
Well, we rattled through an hour easily there, but before we finish up, can you just tell me why people should care about Zcash, what is coming up, and how they can find out more about it?
People should care about Zcash because privacy is really important. It's necessary to really be yourself. You can be yourself when you're alone. You can be yourself with your friends. You can be yourself if you choose to get up in front of somebody, like, I don't know, you're going to your own wedding, or you're going to give a talk or whatever. You can be yourself when you choose who's watching. You can't be yourself when a whole bunch of faceless strangers who may or may not have your best interests at heart are watching you at all times. It's really important for humanity that we allow people to choose who they share information about themselves with.
And how do people find out more about Zcash? Like, is there a certain resource that they should go to?
Yeah, the company has z.cash is our website. So type in z.cash, enter. And there we have videos, tutorials, and all that.
All right, awesome. We should do this again as I have more questions. So let's definitely do a follow-up. Have a great day. Thanks for coming on, and great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to hearing the results.
Okay, so what did you make of that? What did you make of what Zuko had to say? Personally, this was kind of a tricky one for me because I've been a friend of Zuko for a while on Twitter. We've regularly talked, not always just about crypto, but, you know, he's always been decent with me. But at the same time, there are a lot of people I respect and have interviewed and talked to who kind of have issues with the Zcash project. Yeah, it was a really tricky one for me. I'm going to leave the technical aspects to others, but my main issues are that there is this intrinsic link between Zcash, the company, and the protocol, which makes me feel like it's centralized. And one of the most important things I've learned about Bitcoin is how important decentralization is. And I think centralization was ultimately one of the main reasons which DigiCash failed, which Zuko worked on with David Chaum. I also feel like the founders' reward has enriched the founders at the expense of investors who bought into the hype. It doesn't fit comfortably with me. And there was a time when I thought, you know what, the founders created the project, they deserved it. But now, kind of looking at developer incentives and the way these things work, I don't know. It doesn't fit entirely comfortably with me, knowing how people have invested in projects and lost a lot of money. Now, while private transactions may be useful, I don't think they're particularly useful with such a volatile price. And with low liquidity, I can't see how Zcash can get away from that. So I can't really see how people are going to benefit from using the product. And also, look, it's a complicated product to use. Understanding the difference between shielded and unshielded transactions and addresses, that's quite a complicated thing. And I just can't see how that is going to achieve any kind of mainstream adoption. So yeah, quite a long list, really. I'm going to stop short of calling it a scam, which I know plenty of other people have done. And if you search out on Google for Zcash scam, there's lots of people who call it a scam. I think scam is loosely used to describe almost any project outside of Bitcoin sometimes. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I'm going to stop short myself. My main problem is I just feel the project is a little bit pointless. And while Zcash has been successful at achieving some high profile exchange listings, and that's quite impressive seeing as it is a privacy coin, I just don't see the point to it anymore. And I think its survival is now based on a new bull market coming, because if it's being financed by the founder's reward and the price has dropped to, I think it's from like $800 to $50, if that keeps dropping, then I assume they're going to run out of funding for the developers. So yeah, I think there's a lot of risk with Zcash, and it's not really something I'm interested in anymore. I'm much more interested in waiting for better privacy options on Bitcoin. You might disagree with me. You might be a big fan of Zcash. It just doesn't really work for me. I'm sorry. But yeah, if you've got any questions or you've got any counterpoints, do feel free to reach out to me. I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who shared out and fed back to me on my interviews with Peter Todd and Whitfield Diffie. Definitely two great interviews. I've received a lot of great feedback on those. They seem to have gone down very well. So thank you so much. With all the crypto podcasts out there, I am trying hard to get a kind of range of guests. Maybe people aren't appearing on lots of other podcasts. Kind of difficult at times, but these were two really great interviews because I know both of them don't do too many. So yeah, thank you for the feedback, and thank you to everybody who shared them out. And also just thank you to everyone who supports the show. Yes, this is my ramble I say every week, but it really does help with what I'm trying to achieve with the podcast. It doesn't matter what you do, whether you just drop me an email, tell your friends to check out the podcast, or leave a review on iTunes. Everything helps with the podcast. But if you haven't helped and you do want to support the show, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. Firstly, you can make sure you just listen to the ads. Listen to my sponsors. This week it's BlockFi and BitRefill. If you don't listen to the sponsors or the sponsorship doesn't work, I'm not going to have any. And if I don't have any sponsors, then I'm going to have to get a job, and then I'm not going to be able to do the show, and I'm going to be miserable. So make sure you just check out the advertisers. If you don't want to listen to the advertisers, if you just want to skip them, there is a couple of things you can do. You can become a patron. I've got 75 now, which is madness, really. But for $5 a month, you can get each show early and without all the ads and all my nonsense talking at the start and the end. If you don't want to use Patreon, I know there's a lot of negative feedback around Patreon at the moment, you can subscribe for the ad-free version with crypto. I've got 4 people who've done that now. You can email me, I can give you address, and I can add you to the distribution list. I also have a crypto tip jar, which this month has been utterly amazing. So many people have been sending me tips out of appreciation for the work, so thank you for that. All goes towards supporting the show. There are links on my website to how you can do that. You can become a show sponsor. If you're interested in that, then feel free to drop me an email. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Downloads are still growing. January was a record month with over 120,000 downloads of the podcast, which is absolutely mad, but amazing. So yes, if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, do reach out to me. You can leave me a review on iTunes or just click on the subscribe button. Both help with my ranking. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Medium, I'm on Instagram, I'm at What Bitcoin Did on everything. My personal Twitter is at Peter McCormack. DMs are open. I pretty much reply to everyone, unless you're trying to get me to shill something. You can check out my website, www.whatbitcoindid.com. So many useful resources on there. You can sign up to my newsletter. And lastly, you can share the show out with your friends and family. Whew, that was a lot. Okay, so got some great interviews planned coming up soon. I've got an update on Venezuela with my friend Alejandro Macedo, who was on the podcast before. He's going to be joined by Giancarlo Fiorella and Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. I think I've pronounced that wrong. I'm sorry, Mauricio. You can help me pronounce that correctly. I've also got an interview with JW Weatherman looking at crypto scams and Bitcoin onboarding. And on Thursday, I'm recording a show with Lily Liu looking at Bitcoin rationalism. So lots of great interviews coming. Anyway, listen, have a great week. I'll speak to you all soon. And if you've got any questions, do reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.